Hello, everyone. Pack your knives and stay. Yes, stay. It's the return of the Top Chef Judges Table podcast here at robhasawebsite.com. I am Antonio Mazzaro, and I'm judged and joined every week by three people who I have a burning question for. I'm going to go one by one. Josh, where's the beef?
Where's the beef?
Where's the beef, Josh Wiggler?
I'll tell you where the beef is. The beef is between me and Chad!
Oh, no. This is no good. We're going to have to get into this because, Josh, you have no team members left. Team Kurt Clark is doing better, but I want to ask Kurt. Kurt, where's the beef?
You know what? I'm currently kind of chain eating this can of Easy Cheese. I'm hoping it's at the bottom of it. So,
Kurt, you're changing your name to Amr. I got it.
Easy Cheese Clark.
Mike. Yep. I saved the perhaps most dangerous for last. Mike, where's the beef?
Wherever there's soigné, there's beef. That's what I say.
Soigné.
Oh, my gosh. Is that like a new ballet, soigné? Is that the sequel to Swan Lake? Is that what we're
doing here? Black soigné. Yeah, Black soigné, starring Natalie Portman.
Yeah.
When I Googled soigné, like, it came up, there was a salon, soigné salon just outside Chicago that I am never, ever, ever going to go to.
I don't believe you. I believe you might make a visit. Just one visit, Kurt. Just one visit for science's sake. You have to go and do a little investigation and figure out what it is about that salon that is soigné, the soigné. You have to go there and look into it.
It's actually interesting that we have a soigné challenge for the quickfire and we have a Ron Swanson like challenge for the elimination. I feel like that can't be coincidental.
Ron Swanye was in full effect. That is not the title of the episode. The title of this episode is Where's the Beef? I'm Antonio Mazzaro. We're talking Top Chef this season here at robhasawebsite.com and reality wrap-ups. If you like what we're doing here, you can subscribe to our feed that contains all the wrap-ups. You can go to robhasawebsite.com/RHAPUPS, which is not a shipping service that Rob is doing. It is the wrap-ups feed that contains all of our podcasts, not only about Top Chef this season, but also about The Bachelor and The Challenge and so many other great reality shows that are going on at this time. But we want to talk about Top Chef today. And really, the headline is there's no more Team Josh. Josh, let's mourn for a minute about the loss of Team Josh.
Man, it's like I shouldn't have come onto the podcast. You know, I was.
Don't say that.
You know what? I feel like I jinxed it. I feel like maybe if I had never shown up, that my team could have made it to the end. I could have had a repeat of last year where I won the whole thing and Chad could have gone all the way. And if I had just stopped and not allowed myself to get on the podcast here, everything would have been fine and it just would have played out okay. And I screwed up.
Well, I would say that, if anything, the elimination of Team Josh signifies our victory over the machines. Skynet is defeated. There will be no Maximum Overdrive-esque scenario going on. We've officially beaten artificial intelligence
at its
own game.
You know what? I'm happy to be a part of that. Like, if my team had to die so Skynet could fall, I will give you the thumbs up as I descend into the pool of
Perfect.
Lead.
You're the Kyle Reese, Josh.
Yeah. So I'll blow myself up in the factory so that others may live.
Let's reset the teams for just a second. Kurt, who do you have left in the game?
I have Karen, delayed quickfire winner, and Carl.
Karen and Carl. And Mike, yes. Who do you have left in the game?
I guess technically everyone. Jason is surviving in Last Chance Kitchen, and we'll probably talk about that later. A bit of a surprising victory there. But Philip, very surprising elimination challenge winner from this episode. Kwame and Amar are all still in the game.
All right, and I have Marjorie, Jeremy, and Chef Isaac. Josh, I have a proposition for you.
Yeah, let's hear it.
I will allow you to take one of Marjorie or Jeremy for my team.
Why? Why are you giving up your people?
The goodness of my heart, Josh. I want you to have a rooting interest here.
I do want to have a rooting interest, but I don't want to take anybody's team members. What I want to do, I want to co-opt a team. I want to put my life on the line of one of you people. I want to put my fate in the hands of one of your teams and potentially Wiggler curse you down to the bottom of the ocean with me.
Is anyone liking this proposition here?
I'm intrigued by it.
I mean, I'm intrigued. One of our teams are a specific person.
One of your teams.
He wants to co-manage.
I'm going to co-manage. I'll be a silent partner. You'll get all the hugs, all the pizza, all the goofiness, and you can do all of the actual management work.
I'll take the offer if no one else is interested.
I'm in on Chef Mazzaro. That's the team I want anyway.
Right. I was curious if the Wiggler curse and the Clark curse would cancel each other out, personally.
Mm. You know what? The only person on your team that I feel like can win this thing is Karen. And I think that Karen could be the winner of this season. But you only have two people. Antonio's got three. I like Marjorie's shot. I like Jeremy's shot. Isaac, if he can pull it together, I feel like he's got a winner's edit. So I think Antonio has the most well-rounded team.
Is everybody okay with this? Are we on board with this? We have a Wiggzaro team going in play here.
You know what? I feel like it wouldn't be a podcast and the Rob Has a Podcast Network if that partnership did not occur. So I feel like it's very sound.
We have a very, very serious thing between Antonio and I. And I feel like we should just, you know, you were talking about this isn't a shipping service, but I ship this, Antonio.
That's fair. All right.
I know others do as well.
So my team now has a co-manager, which is certainly seeming to doom it to failure, but we're going to see what happens here.
We'll go down together, man. It'll be great.
Oh boy.
Or if you win, does that mean that Josh can take technical credit and say, no, I actually did win two seasons in a row because
Absolutely.
I ended up with the winning team.
I'm okay with that. I'm still going to get co-champ, so it's fine.
Yeah.
There's never been a co-champion of Top Chef. So we're breaking new ground here in Top Chef season 13 and episode 7, Where's the Beef? We're breaking new ground. That's all there is to it.
We can figure that out the further along we get in this thing. You know, maybe we can reset the stakes later on. But right now, let's align, Antonio. Let's make an alliance.
Let's do it.
For a draft that has zero stakes on the table, I'm perfectly okay with you two joining forces.
And not having stakes on the table was the big problem this episode.
I was going to say, for an episode without stakes on the table, it's a good segue.
Yeah, it's perfect because it is a segue. It is a soignee segue, which is too many words that sound very similar and make you sound pretentious in a row. But it's a soignee segue into what the heart of the main challenge in this episode is, the beefsteak. We'll get to that in a minute. But first, I think we really should talk about the cold open. We haven't really – this is a very distinct cold open in this episode. We find out that Kwame not only had problems with his dad when he was younger, but also now is a drug dealer somehow. Did anybody see this coming?
No. I mean, Kwame continues to be the most interesting person in the competition just with his myriad of stories every week. And I'm going to spoil The Wire for a second. So if you haven't seen The Wire, tune out for the next like 30 seconds. But I was getting shades of like Naaman Bryce here. I don't know if you guys felt the same way in terms of like kid who had a good heart and was fortunately thrust in a situation where he started selling drugs, but he found a good name for himself and decided to step away out of that business.
Maybe more like Randy, because he had like a candy sale thing going on before he, you know, took the next step in his life. But yeah, there's definitely an interesting backstory with Kwame. And I don't know, I think the true depth of his biography is certainly not going to be revealed on this episode or any episode of Top Chef, but he has a fascinating backstory and we just keep kind of swiping at it and getting big chunks of it as we go. So the first thing we find out in this episode is that last episode was rough for Kwame because he was not only going back to a time when he was thinking about his dad, he was also going back to a time when he was a really good drug dealer. And if he could, you know, be really good at that, imagine if he could be really good at something he's passionate about. And that's what brings him to being a chef. On the other hand, someone who's passionate about themselves is Philip. And Philip says he had a breakthrough. Judge's table. He had a therapy session. He had a little therapy session and he's fine. This is the end. We're going to see a new Philip going forward, aren't we, Mike?
That's questionable. I think we'll talk about the elimination challenge and how I actually kind of feel like Philip kind of lucked his way into a win here just because everyone else completely misinterpreted the challenge except for Philip. So, I'm sort of loving this trajectory, though, because remember Philip a couple episodes ago was like, okay, now I'm just going to focus on cooking technically proficient food. And then that didn't go well. And now he says, okay, F it. I'm just going to cook what I want. And that ends up proving successful for him now. But guys, I feel like there should be balloons falling from the ceiling here. We did it. Philip has made it to Restaurant Wars. And I apologize, Josh, that it was at the cost of your last teammate. But our goal has been accomplished. I'm so happy about that.
Apologize to no one, because if my team had to die, not only for Skynet to die, but so that Philip may move on to Restaurant Wars, I will fall on that sword every day of the week. If the question is keep Chad alive or bring Philip to Restaurant Wars, bring Philip to Restaurant Wars every day of the week.
And here's the thing, guys. Not only is Philip going to Restaurant Wars, he's going to Restaurant Wars, one, off of a win, and two, confident that he can just be himself. Yeah. So this is like a win-win-win situation.
It's a win-win-win, and here's another win. It's a two-part episode. It's a Restaurant Wars is going to be so epic that it's a two-parter, and Philip coming out of a win is a part of it.
Oh, well, I didn't realize that.
Yeah. And another win, apparently, and not to talk too much about the next episode, but they're doing a twist where everyone's taking turns being front of house and executive chef, so there's no way that his team can push Philip in a corner and just let him be himself to block his creative influence. He's going to have to have some sort of hand in his restaurant.
No one puts Philip in a corner. He's going to wear that blazer, go front of house, and tell everybody the pretentious things that he can think of about their one-day restaurant, and that he's going to have to go and run and work in the back of the house as either a line cook, or he's going to have to take over some exec duties. So we'll get to that. We'll get to the great tease for the most supersized Restaurant Wars ever on Top Chef. To end the cold open here, Chef Amar says that the season is up for grabs. Do you guys feel that way, Josh? You said you thought Karen could possibly win. How many potential winners do you see out there right now?
Yeah, so just looking at the board, you know, I jotted down all the names of the people that are still left based on teams. I think Karen is in the mix for sure. I'm just out on Chef Carl, but maybe Chef Carl is going to sneak in here. I mean, he's doing better than I expected. I think Jason is probably not going to leave Last Chance Kitchen, and even if he does, I do not see him winning. Philip, no way. That would be fun, but no chance. Kwame, I think, has a real shot. Amar, dark horse candidate, I think he's potentially in it. Marjorie, I feel like, has a good shot. Isaac, I could see it. Jeremy, I could see it. So that's what? That's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 potential winners, according to my count. And I could even see Carl maybe doing it. And the only two I would say no shot are Jason and Philip.
Anybody have any downside or disagreement to that?
I mean, I would probably narrow my choices down specifically to probably Jeremy, Marjorie, and Kwame. Just based on the entire body of work, I feel like those three have always, from an editing perspective, have always kind of shown in some sort of respective light in every episode so far, whether good or bad, or just from a storytelling perspective. So I feel like if we're trying to play that game in terms of having a winner who is somewhat present in every episode, I feel like those three are the big major candidates on top of their proficient cooking.
No Karen.
I think Karen has had spikes here and there, and I think she's had a good couple weeks, but she's also had a bad couple weeks as well. And I mean, Kwame is in a very similar manner too, but I don't know. It's tough for me to count Kwame out just because of all this story we're getting from him, you know?
Yeah. Kurt, where do you stand on this? Wide open season?
For me, yeah. For me, it's a wide open season. And it's really tough for me to go on just the editing. I think we've seen, like, we thought that, oh, this was potentially a redemption story for Grace, and then she's gone the next week. And I thought for sure we were going to get a redemption episode for Kwame, given how poorly he did. And it opened up with the story of, like, you know, how the past was actually tougher for him than we thought. And he does poorly for a second week in a row. And so, like, I'm a little bit worried for Kwame and Isaac, who've kind of had, you know, two not that great back-to-back showings. But at the same time, I still see that, you know, both of them potentially turning around and winning it. So I'm also a lot higher on Carl than Josh is. But so I could honestly see anybody going all the way except for Philip.
Carl is such a Kurt Clark chef testant. Like, he's the classic Nicholas mold.
Yeah. Well, wait.
You love those guys.
No, okay,
you love those guys.
I see. Oh boy,
you love your leading men, boring vanilla chef testings, Kurt.
Wow,
Josh, shots you take over fired. Half of my team, and you start firing broadsides at this.
This is what I'm doing. I'm attracting all the bullets to your team, Anton.
This is no good.
What happens when you sign me on.
Oh my gosh, I didn't know that. I'm not sure, Kurt. Do you want to defend yourselves against these broadsides at all?
I see Carl and Nicholas as two very, very, very different polarizing contestants. Yes, they are both white males, but that's where I'll draw the line at the distinction.
I'm with you on this one, Kurt. And I actually think that Carl has a shot. I wouldn't say that he has a great shot. I think Carl and Amar are about the same in terms of their shot to win the competition. I think both in this competition have shown themselves to be fairly talented chefs and put some good food out there that has gotten them some recognition. And Amar's story seems to be that he's always kind of on the team that does well, but he's never really the one who gets the credit. And that certainly does not happen this week. But I think that his week may be coming. And there's been just so many other winners from week to week or in the quick fires. I think it's reflective of what we've said all along about this season, which is that the talent level is very high.
I do feel like I know more about Carl's wife than I do about Carl. His wife has lived. Yes. His wife has lived everywhere.
Yeah. Did you guys know that, you know, Carl went to Nicaragua? Did you not see it on his giant hat that he had in one of those pictures? I feel like we know more about Nicaragua than we do about Carl.
Can we have Carl's wife come on and replace Carl?
We need
another family challenge from last season because need Carl's wife and we need Philip's wife. We need
they're setting him up for the family visit.
You mean his sister? I mean, they look exactly alike. I'm not trying to cast aspersions there, but side by side, Philip and his wife look like they could be related other than through marriage.
Oh, a little bit of a Lannister thing going
there,
on.
Yeah,
here.
And there is a sort of theory that goes around that, and this is a weird tangent, but in terms of like homosexuality, some people believe that like males and females try to find people that look like them if they're attracted to the same sex. And maybe it's a similar way with Philip, but just heterosexually. He's really attracted to people that look like him but happen to be female.
Crackpot theories aside, it is interesting. Megan had commented on our episode 7 page at Reality Wrap Ups that Philip dated a girl in Peru, apparently in Canada. In the course of the show, he's referred to his wife as an actress, a model, and the pastry chef at his restaurant. So maybe Philip's wife is just Philip with a black wig on, and there's a lot of photo imagery going on. We don't know about that phone conversation. Was he talking to a recording of himself? It's really hard to tell with Philip what's going on, but he does seem to love his wife, so it would make sense if she and he were the same person, because he also seems to love himself. I don't know. We'll talk more about Philip as this episode goes along, because there are a couple of really great Philip scenes. The editors are having a lot of fun with Philip, and for that reason alone, I agree with you, Josh. No shot Philip wins this competition.
Zero chance.
No.
He's getting the dodo music in the quickfire. It's just not going
to
happen.
There's just no chance. There's no chance. I mean, he could make it to the finale, and wouldn't we be so lucky? But there's no shot. No chance.
I feel bad for, like, tuba players everywhere, that their craft has been, like, you know,
that's true.
Like, the moment you hear a tuba, you're like, okay, dodo music. Yeah.
Just so bad. Yep. So that's exactly. I put tuba player in my notes as well, Kurt. I think it's really funny because the tuba just brings a lot of the comedy. And speaking of the comedy, does anyone speak a good enough French to loosely translate Jacques Lemaire for me?
It's basically jack shit, right?
Yeah, that's what I think. Yeah. Yeah, so this this famous Instagram, had anyone heard of Jacques Lemaire before we started here?
No.
I'm not on Instagram, so I have no idea who this person is.
I hadn't. I thought they were going to bring out, there's a food blogger called Foodiggity that I follow, and I was kind of excited because they've done this really neat thing recently where they've basically made each of the states into a food. You kind of have to see it to understand it. And I thought they were going to do that because it's some really creative food photography. I thought that's where they're going with it. But no, this was a complete, utter surprise. But I really, really liked this quickfire.
Loved it. Loved this challenge.
Is, oh my, Mike, so good. I know you're a big fan of season 3 when Hung has to make the
Smurf
forest.
Smurf
Village. Are there any other notable non-eating quickfires that stand out to everyone where it's just about plating or presentation?
I mean, the one big thing I'm thinking of is it's not non-eating, but in season 9, Grayson's first season, I remember there was the challenge associated with Snow White and the Huntsman, I think, where Charlize Theron was the judge. And I think, I forget who it was, whether it was Grayson or Ed from that season, put just like this big bloody mess on the plate to resemble the gore of the movie. And Charlize Theron loved it. But I can't think of too many visual, visceral moments from recent
seasons.
Yeah,
there was the red handprint from, I think that was Chef Paul, and there was the black chicken that we saw in that episode. So there was some really cool creative food there, and Charlize Theron was really getting into it. So that was a really good notable challenge about plating as well. You guys said, Josh, you seem to really love this challenge. What are your thoughts overall on this challenge and how it played out throughout the course of the episode in particular?
Well, before I get into that, let me first just say Kurt brought up Foodiggity, and then I went on a little bit of a dive on the internet, and this is good stuff. Check out Foodiggity. Pretzelvania, that's creative. Yeah. Baconetiquette.
I can't wait to see what Kentucky is.
I can't do that real quick. There's West Virginia Bread Man.
Kentucky.
Kentucky? Of course.
Idaho, Kansas for cranberries. And they make the state out of new pork. They make the state out of the foods, a smorgon.
Oh, that's really easy for Connecticut then, because Connecticut's like the size of your thumb.
Yeah. Fish again, anybody? California.
Oh, I've seen this
that's
before.
That's apropos.
Keene, Washington.
All right, back on
anyway,
track.
Sorry.
I loved this challenge. So much about this challenge. I mean, I think just what I just did speaks to it. Like, I obsessively look at food on the internet. I always am Googling pizza because I'm a monster. I'm eating with my eyes like 24/7. So it resonates with me. I'm the jerk who does the Instagrams of his food.
Same here.
You know, yeah, I know your Blue Apron stuff, Kurt. I love that. I always like that. Yeah. I always like those pics. So, I mean, it's very much a part of our culture. Some people hate it. Other people are really into it. I happen to be really into it. And so it resonated with me. It's a visual show, you know, TV just by nature of what it is. It's a visual medium. So what are we doing when we're watching Top Chef and talking about Top Chef? We're not tasting any of that food. We're tasting it with our freaking eyes. So for the fact that the challenge is actually about that, I really like that. I thought that was very clever. So that's one piece of it that I really liked. The other piece that I really, really, really liked is that we did not know who was immune until it was too late. You know, until the elimination challenge was finished, until everything was awarded, we had no idea who was going to be safe. And I think that sometimes you see people who are safe, they can just kind of cakewalk through the elimination challenge and they can screw up. And we saw it with, I think it was with Jeremy a week or two ago when they're like, Jeremy, if you weren't safe, you know, we would be talking to you later. So I like that this requires everybody to be at their best because they just don't know how they did on this challenge. So I turned to my wife while we were watching. I was like, they should do this challenge every single season. This is an awesome challenge. It's one of my favorites that Top Chef has ever
done. Now, was it your wife or was it just you in a black wig?
It was me in a black wig.
I can't get past Josh saying I just Google pizza sometimes.
I do.
I know.
Like you're probably like five pages deep into the Google search.
Oh, I go deep. I go deep.
Yeah,
I go.
Is Rule 34 in effect with pizza Google?
Yeah, I go deep into like any sort of pizza-y hashtag on Instagram. I just like I constantly check the NYC pizza hashtag to see what's going on in my state. Yeah, that's what's up.
And I think you're right, Josh. It was such a simple little twist on the quickfire of just delaying. I mean, the act of delaying the announcement of who wins, I thought had a major impact on probably how they played the game, but then also I think a little bit unlike what I was anticipating for the show. And it nicely tied into the whole Instagram 24 hours to vote thing. But it's the sort of reveal that could easily happen with any challenge. It's like, yeah, you cook something and we have a winner, but their name's in this envelope. So you all have to basically cook your damnedest until maybe, like, what if you reveal it halfway through the challenge on day two? So someone suddenly feels a little bit easier. I don't know. I really liked the simplicity of the twist.
Now, in these little commercial interstitials, they showed like the quote unquote live updates of the likes that were going on for this challenge. And it's weird because the first one showed like the top three were Chad, Carl, and Philip. And then I believe the second one showed three completely different people. I think it was I was confused as to A, when they decide to just randomly take updates and post them on the commercial breaks, and B, why it suddenly flip-flopped completely after a short amount of time.
Yeah, I was going to ask you this, Kurt, because you're a big fan of taking polls about food online. Most specifically, which coffee should I drink?
Which coffee should I drink? Yeah,
oh, it's incredible stuff.
So my question for you, Kurt, and it's kind of a two-parter. The first part is how do you think they were really updating these? I mean, was this clearly for the viewers at home to add suspense to who was winning? But I mean, were they just taking a snapshot of the poll at a certain time and posting that? And second, I just want to know overall how you feel about what Top Chef has done specifically this season to integrate social into the decisions and the game and just the show in general.
Nothing's more riveting than watching four judges in a car talking about how they're tweeting. Is that
right?
That was kind of in my notes for this was like, logistically, how did they decide to pull this off? Because I'm thinking all of a sudden, like if you're following the Top Chef account and you suddenly have, nine photos in a row, if you get posted first or last there, especially if you get posted last, you're going to have like a potentially a lot more votes. It's going to be the most recent people's stream. So it's like, I thought it was a really neat idea, but there was like so many things in the process that could have skewed it towards a particular person. The way I figured that they had to have done it was they said they were going to keep the polls open for 24 hours or at least until the next day. And they probably just took snapshots like of, you know, who are the top three every 5 hours or so. It's weird because it happened at a point in time where these, you don't know, and I can't remember from the screenshots of the Instagram accounts if they didn't even like link it. They didn't make any mention of who a chef was.
No.
Even at this point though, like the show is not airing. You don't know who these people are anyway. I was really curious about how they decided to pull this off. You get Instagram posts with, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of likes. So I'm not that surprised that the lead shifted, but I am a bit surprised that some people just go through and like all nine photos. So I'm surprised that there was as much variance as we saw.
Yeah, me too. That's what I was thinking, is it's difficult to understand how people weren't just voting for every single one, but we didn't see the official instructions. I don't think any of us saw this real time. I don't follow the Top Chef account on Instagram. I'm not really a big Instagram user. So I didn't see it real time. It doesn't sound like anyone else did. So if anybody listening saw that real time or voted on any of these things real time, let us know in the comments at our page at realityrehapups@robhasawebsite.com how this played out real time, if this was something that you saw or if you were specifically instructed to vote for only a certain number, because we did find out that the winner, which we'll get to momentarily, I had over 5,000 of the 23,000 votes. So that does seem to be a pretty pretty important sample from that size. So who knows exactly how that played out. Before we had this quickfire, we had Karen and Marjorie kind of have a little scene where they said, we're going to take the guys down one by one. And we don't really see competitiveness or competition in this quickfire. Everybody's kind of doing their own thing. And as a matter of fact, a lot of people are looking at Carl and saying, Carl's got this on lock. Carl is doing, Mike, can you describe what Carl was doing here?
So the way Carl describes it, he uses the terms cascading garden. And one of the things I love about this challenge too, is how, with the exception of one person, everyone's just having a lot of fun with this. And there's a lot of like tongue in cheek, poking fun at sort of the art world. And so Carl's sort of saying like, a little sarcastically, oh yeah, I'm going for a real nature versus man-made theme, serving as a form of social commentary. And so what he did basically was he took like a can from like a spam.
Yeah.
And then he basically formed a bunch of different, for those of you that didn't watch, basically it's, you have to form the best looking plate using only junk food. And that's what Jacques Lemaire does, basically makes things look pretty with only junk food. And so Carl took the spam and basically made little rolls out of them. And he used a bunch of things like carrots, cocoa soil, beef jerky, cone-shaped corn snacks, which are basically bugles, but I'm pretty sure bugles did not allow them to say bugles, and that's why they had to say cone-shaped corn snacks. That's a tongue twister.
Wow, say that five times fast.
But basically, he was trying to make these almost like food flowers emerging from this metallic can. And I agree, that was by far the most impressive one for me. I'm honestly a little surprised that Karen won this one.
I wasn't surprised that Carl didn't win, because for me, when they showed the photo, it just looked like almost too much. It reminds me, and then this is, and actually, Mike, you might actually appreciate this. It reminds me of that episode of The Mole where they had to basically create a fake piece of installment art.
Yeah, the boxing gloves with the necklace next to it.
And adding that one or two little extra elements, put it over the top and made it identifiable as a forgery. And yeah. And that's what I think for Carl's, it just seemed like too much was going on, whereas a lot of the other plates are a lot more, I think, simple and straightforward. But it did seem like kind of the spam can as cornucopia sort of approach to the challenge.
Yeah, and this was like Mike was saying, this is a challenge where really the parameters were wide open. It was just make an interesting looking plate. And if anyone follows Chef Jacques Lemaire on Instagram, I don't know about you guys, but I could tell pretty much right away that was junk food there. I recognized bagel bites. I recognized some Sun Chips. I recognized some Snicker bars. But it was made, these are, you know, things that are made to look like fine dining kind of dishes. And that was, of course, the goal here. This is something that some chefs really felt like they embraced and had fun with. Karen wanted to do what she was saying was a representation of her on that plate. So she wanted like a hot pink with a black and a white and like a really cool kind of 50s retro look. And that's kind of what she did. Chad fancies himself an artist. We didn't really know this about Chad. Probably should have been a sign that Chad might have been going this episode, but we found out that Chad is an artist, and his mom told him that the empty plate is his canvas, and a light went on. And so he's been kind of plating and cooking since then, hand in hand. And Jeremy is looking for protein. So for me, it's not going to go well for Jeremy from the start because he's upset there's no proteins in the challenge. I mean, I don't know that Jeremy really was jumping on board with what this was. Did anybody stand out to you guys as really bad? Like what they put forward was just a laughably bad and not really having any shot in the challenge?
I don't think anything was as laughably bad as like Hung Smurf Village, for example. But I mean, Isaac, I think, kind of hits the bottom here. I mean, and Isaac even admitted, like, I'm not a very clean or pretty cook. And I think it was Marjorie who said last episode, you know, Isaac's a great cook, but he's not very, you know, technically proficient in terms of producing pretty food on the plate. And so that definitely came to show here into the fact where Isaac said, like, my young daughters could come do this challenge and they'd be much better at it than I did. And again, like it wasn't terrible. It was just very simple. It was a cheese and fruit cart where he basically took a bunch of different things and made little towers out of them. But it wasn't anything outstanding.
Yeah, I had Isaac on my list. And actually, I wasn't that impressed with what Carl put forward. Those are kind of the two that stuck out in my mind as I could do better than that. In terms of, I really wanted to, like, after this episode was done, like, walk over to the local Walgreens, grab a bunch of junk food, and try my own hand at this. Because this to me took, like, no, I think this was more of, like, an artistic eye. And I would have loved to have just at least seen how I'd done.
I mean, what's stopping us?
I had to, like, leave my couch and go out into the cold.
Well,
yeah, we don't want that.
Can't we do this in time for next week's podcast and have everybody vote on a winner?
Oh boy!
I like that.
Are you guys ready to embrace this, Kurt? How do you feel?
I'm honestly not going to be able to. I have to actually leave town for work tomorrow. So
he bailed. He's out.
Sorry.
Logistics. Josh, if you and Mike want to have a competition, I think that would be great.
Okay,
I'll have to get an Instagram account, but maybe we can try it. We'll talk
about it. It'll be a great first Instagram for you.
I think that's right. I think it allows people to eat with their eyes, like you said, Josh. How do you feel about people who eat with their eyes? It sounds great, right?
I feel real good about it.
And also, who could oppose that idea?
Oh my God, I love that's like that's one of the best like editing moments I can remember recently in Top Chef. It's very like Survivor-esque, where I know we keep making these Philip versus Coach comparisons, but this is like a textbook Coach scene, right? Where Philip says, "Oh, you eat with your eyes before you eat with your mouth." Immediately cuts to Isaac. Whoever says they eat with their eyes should be stabbed in the eye with a pork chop bone. It's just such a great moment.
Yeah, the quick fire was really fun for that, and really just fun for bringing out the pretension in kind of the idea of food. Jacques Lemaire, of course, is poking fun at that and mentions the word soigner like we talked about several times. We have a great montage where you actually hear the producer ask Isaac, what does soigner mean? You know,
that's so good. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really good. Top Chef is just so well edited and so well put together. And that little montage of the chefs talking about that word was really good. We also got another kind of sneaky foreshadowing edit moment, which I didn't realize until I watched the second time, where Chef Jacques Lemaire says, "Tweezers aren't just for microgreens, bro." And then they show Chad and he's laughing.
Not good.
Because microgreens did come back to haunt Chad in the elimination challenge. So we get through this. We don't have a winner. We do have a dodo scene with Philip, like we talked about, where Philip just approaches the table with his and really is setting up a shot, talking about the sunlight and the aperture, and he's adjusting the lens and he's doing different angles and he's, you know, framing it like he wants to look for the camera. Kurt, I'm wondering, somebody had tweeted, let's exactly drill this down. We had some tweets about Philip in this episode in particular, and you had weighed in on the kind of controversy that was in play. Stephen K asked, "Has there been a reality show contestant with a more punchable face than Philip ever?" And Kurt, you said, "If we're talking about the same moment in the show, then no." Let me know when this moment in the show arises, Kurt.
I will. Okay, this is not it. This is not it. But
this is not it.
No. Are we sure Stephen K is not an alias for Dan Foley?
I also loved how Padme was like, okay, that's enough, Phil. Just take the damn picture.
Yeah, that was great. 3, 2, 1. They're really having fun with Philip here.
I just started following Chef Jacques Lemaire on Instagram, and I love the captions are in all caps and shouting with lots of exclamation points, like the bro chef as the character behind Jacques Lemaire is supposed to be. It's actually quite amusing.
They also, I don't know if you saw this in your searches, Kurt, that they the identity of Chef Jacques Lemaire has been revealed.
Well, wasn't that the? I thought that was the woman. That came out on the show, I thought. That it was
I missed that.
Yeah, it's Christine Flynn. You missed the person that was standing next to Padma
My team's co-manager. I don't know. Oh, gosh.
I'm out.
This is going to go great. I'm out. No, you were kidding, right, Josh? That was a joke. So anyway, the identity has been revealed. Before the identity was revealed, was anyone thinking it might be Nathan Fielder? I was really hoping it was Nathan Fielder.
Yes.
I got a great idea for your restaurant. You know, just plate up a bunch of people like the way food looks. It doesn't really matter what it's made out of. So here we go. Let's just make it out of junk food and make it look really nice.
Is it possible that Philip is Nathan Fielder in disguise?
He did do a great job donning that, becoming that person's identity in the season 3
exactly.
finale.
Yeah.
I feel like it's within his statute of limitations there that he'll be able to do that.
He's got that in his skill set, becoming another man.
It would not be Top Chef would never cross promote another platform or show like that. They wouldn't, like, for example, take 2 minutes out of a commercial break and have the Voltaggio brothers talking about being stranded at sea as the Coast Guard. They wouldn't do that, would they?
Oh my God.
Mike, you've been dying to talk about this.
I forgot how boring Brian Voltaggio is. It was horrifically scripted. I can't believe we have to cook for the Coast Guard. Isn't that surprising? I guess we should go get to it.
My DVR must have found that boring because I completely skipped that and did not see it. I didn't even know this was a thing. I don't think it's as much an egregious error as completely missing the reveal of Chef Jacques Lemaire.
What are you talking about?
I
edited that part out.
Oh,
yeah,
sorry.
That didn't happen.
Didn't happen, sorry. Yeah, I missed the Voltaggio retrospective.
I must have been Googling pizza around the time of that reveal. So.
I fast forwarded through it as well, but then once I saw the Voltaggio brothers, I'm like, oh, I guess this is like a little extra thing I might as well watch since we saw Michael last week. And it's very clear that I'm going to sports here. I think if the Voltaggio brothers are the Manning brothers, I feel like in terms of personality, Brian Voltaggio is the Eli Manning. In comparison to his brother.
I think that's right. I think that's a good sports, Mike. You did pretty well with that.
Wow. Now the balloons are really falling from the ceiling. I made a correct sports reference.
I want to know, though, who thought that this would move the needle at all? Did anyone go see this movie, Finest Hours, because the Voltaggio brothers made this commercial?
Again, where's Shireen? We have to talk to Shireen about that.
I'm picturing, like, you know what we can do? If we want to really market this film, we'll get those Voltaggio brothers, and in the middle of Top Chef, we'll make a commercial that looks so much like a commercial that even people who like the Voltaggio brothers and the show Top Chef will skip it. So I don't understand this. Look, I'm all for this. I like guerrilla marketing. I would love to see like next summer's big Pixar movie turn into a Top Chef commercial somehow. They even had the Top Chef music, like, all right, chefs, it's time to plate. And like you were saying, Mike, Michael Voltaggio did really well with this. He was at ease. It was fine. Brian Voltaggio had a big stick up his butt and was a robot. So it was really difficult.
I thought we killed the robots.
A point. Oh, no, they've come back.
Yes. They're back.
It's Voltaggio Genesis.
1 point in favor of Josh's earlier theory. I was rooting for Brian Voltaggio in that season.
It's a skin job.
Listen, so I wasn't going to say anything because I felt like I stepped on a landmine earlier. But now that you've said it, you read my mind again. Incredible.
Find the bland, boring person who could potentially be from the Midwest, and I'm probably rooting for them.
It's Team Clark. I love it.
We just try to root for the people that we think deserve to win. So, Kurt, you clearly have a preference for bland Midwesterners on TV. So I don't blame you.
And Carl's in Boston, so you can't really say that he's Midwest. But I would definitely remember rooting for Brian. But I think a first round episode 1 pick that where I tried to stick with the person throughout.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you knew it was going to be a Voltaggio brother in the end. It was just a question of which one.
Well, the odds were in their favor in terms of any other person.
They got two.
Yeah, exactly.
Before we fully move on, Risa Islam had tweeted at us, does anyone really believe that Philip doesn't say Soignier?
I think that's going to be the name of his third restaurant if he wins Top Chef.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that, you know, he left this episode, and if we don't hear Philip saying, oh, that's so Soignier in Restaurant Wars, I'm going to be surprised.
Is that the new Disney Channel spinoff?
Yeah.
it's the back half of Once Upon a Time, Mike. It's Dark Soignier.
Yeah. Oh, I'm excited for the Dark Soignier arc coming this fall or this March on Once Upon a Time.
Yeah.
I'm excited for the beefsteak on this episode, even though, again, speaking of bland, the Chef Neil that comes in to deliver this, looking like David Spade mixed with David Grohl a little bit. I don't know who this guy is. Has anyone ever heard of this guy?
I have not, but just the idea of like David Spade playing David Grohl in a biopic sounds like the worst movie of all time.
Well, we got it here at the beginning of the introduction of this elimination challenge. He comes out and he talks about the beefsteak. The beefsteak, as Spin56 tweeted at us, Top Chef has totally gone full bloom this week. The beefsteak opens the door for so many. It opens the door wide, like gaping. The door is open.
And so here
into that door, the chefs have to enter and be meaty. They have to just cook a big meat dish, and beef is never specifically mentioned. This is a bone of contention, if you will, to introduce this challenge, whether beef is required or not. Turns out that the teams are kind of assigned by how people are standing. And two out of the three teams decide that they're not going to cook beef. And one of the three teams decides they have to cook beef. So that's the way that all plays out. Everyone thinks Isaac, or Marjorie specifically thinks Isaac, may be a really good kind of contestant for this because he has a restaurant called Toops's Meatery. Would you guys eat at a restaurant called a meatery?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Nice. All right. Just making sure we're on the same page.
I just want to know if there's a restaurant that would trump meatery. I mean, other than like, you know, S'more Katessen. I'm trying to think like what could actually draw me away from a meatery.
Probably a restaurant called Lots of Pizza. I feel like Josh would prefer over the meatery day of the week.
A pizzery.
Yes. Chucky the Cheese.
Chucky the Cheese. Yeah. I love Chucky the Cheese. Hook it up.
So yeah, the big question was whether cooking beef was okay, but meat is clearly on order, even though Chad and Amar are making fish. And Philip wants to make, he says it right away here. So this is not any, there's no chance here for Philip's revisionist history. We see Philip at the beginning of the challenge in the planning phase say, I really want to make a food that you can pick up and eat with your hand. That is like, you know, even though that's what everyone has to do in the challenge, Philip is very dug in that he wants to make a meat on the bone that he can pick up almost like a lollipop is what he says. So there we go. We also have this really weird scene right at the beginning in the prep phase where Chef Isaac says that Chef Amar is Spanish Santa Claus. Is that what he said?
Yeah. So I mean, like, he liked the way he says food.
And then Amar is dancing around saying food, haha, food. So I don't know. There's a lot of fun stuff going on in the prep. Chad wants to come up with this medieval plating where he's going to ash char the fish that he's making. We get a little scene here where Amar says he really likes Philip. He sees himself in Philip, and Philip just needs to grow up a little bit. And we get Philip then calling home, and we have this kind of tender conversation with Philip. I would say that this, absent everything else we know about Philip, this is sort of like a winner scene because Philip talks about why he wants to win Top Chef and how he emptied his bank accounts out and how he didn't get support from his parents, even though they could have. This is smart editing, I think, from Top Chef. But at least in my mind, this isn't winning anyone over. No one is believing, oh, now Philip has a chance because he's a more well-rounded person because one of the other chefs said they liked him. And we saw him have a tender moment with his wife.
And it seems that, like, to be fair, we seems like we have one of these tender moments between a contestant and their loved one every episode, if not at least every other episode. I mean, we've seen it with Karen, we've seen it with Carl, and so we get this repeatedly, I think, but this might be like the one time where we actually see it actually lead to a win for the person.
Yeah, this is because this is foreshadowing Philip's win for this episode a little bit. As I said, they're not fooling me. I don't think that you have your winner of the season get the dodo edit that they gave Philip in the quickfire. I could be wrong about that, but that to me seemed to signal that this is not somebody they're propping up as somebody who is bringing it on a level that should win the show. They're almost, you know, giving him the comedic edit along with the eat with your eyes, pork bone kind of thing. So. I don't know. Somebody who is getting a pretty good edit, I think, is Marjorie. Marjorie's making bread. in this kind of challenge, which is odd. I think her reasoning is good. Yeah. Sop up all the juices. It's a vessel, all of that. Isaac is poking holes in his sausage. Oh, the sausage came out dry. I got news for you. If you poke holes in a sausage and all the fat juices run out, it's going to come out a little bit dry. So I don't know if that's what he was doing. This is a dish he's made a ton. So maybe it was just the prep kind of scenario there was a little bit difficult in that particular kitchen, or the volume of sausage he had to make came into play, because I highly doubt that the dish is not good. It just didn't come off as well as he wanted it to that day, I guess. Marjorie is in the kitchen going full bloom. Mike, do you have anything to say about Marjorie's comments here?
Maybe I didn't write them. Is she talking about how she's between sausage and tuna? Is that what you're alluding to?
Leave it to you to open the door to something that really wasn't in the edit. No, she.
I'm making a.
We're just rolling out the red carpet for Mike here. Just walk,
I was trying.
Mike,
yeah,
go
I was
in that
trying.
Direction and walk say what you want.
Coordination edit going on here. I don't think I wrote it down. What are you alluding to?
She tells Philip it's a shame that he has to use two bones per person to get the job done. And, you know, everybody kind of go. Oh, everybody, did I make that up? Did anybody else see
no,
that?
No, I caught that as well. And I didn't take notes on it because I figured that Mike would be all over it. I mean, not to throw shade, Mike. But I was like, yeah, this is. I was like, all I could think about, Mike's going to have a field day with this when we get to it. But luckily for the rating of the podcast, it kind of slipped by unnoticed.
Yeah, Marjorie is just is really having fun in the kitchen. I think the point of those scenes, she's also kind of going back and forth with Isaac and talking about how he has no grace whatsoever. And he's just throwing his sausage out there for everyone. And she's just really kind of dishing it out in the kitchen. And everybody, she's really kind of a boss. I'm a really big fan of Marjorie.
She's great. She's obviously very talented. You know, she's won some competitions here. She's really good at what she does. She's funny. She's observant. You know, she has made some very astute comments about the people that she is competing against. I really like Marjorie in this competition. I really like her shot at winning this thing.
Can we talk a little, like, what did you guys think? I mean, you know, backing up a little, like the concept of the beefsteak, like I'd never heard of this before in terms of, you know, no utensils, no plates, no napkins. And they have to, each team has to make a beef dish, a fish dish, and a side. Like I was sitting there wondering, like, what kind of side dish can you make where you're just going to eat it with your hands? And I was even like stymied a little bit by some of the selections that people had, like when they're doing, like, so, you know, grilled vegetables, I can see, but, you know, so Jeremy's fried Brussels sprouts and bacon, like, so they're going to be eating that with their hands. Like, I don't typically think, and I was thinking, like, a fish dish with hands seemed like a little bit odd to me as well. But yeah. I really liked the concept of this challenge. What did you guys think of it?
First of all, I want to like buy a reserve a seat to the meter to this beefsteak right away because I absolutely love this concept. It's very like medieval times, if anyone's ever gone to medieval times, in terms of they serve you like these big chicken legs and you have to eat it with your hands. That being said, I mean, I think it's clear that none of the chefs had experienced beefsteak. So they really, I think they were trying to do, at least Kwame's idea behind the peel and eat shrimp was like, okay, this is something you can do with your hands, but it's not supposed to be messy. But Tom actually says in the middle of this challenge, no, it's supposed to be, this table is supposed to be one big, juicy, bloody mess by the end of the meal. And so I think the chefs totally misfired on a few points, the main one being that it's supposed to be messy. They were trying to make meals that people can pick up with their hands but not get themselves dirty because they're wearing a tuxedo basically to this. And even though they're wearing an apron, there's going to be a lot of juice that's flying around. But no, the judges were all about, I want to get messy, take chances, make mistakes and get messy here. And I want to be, you know, covered in everything. So give me the messiest stuff possible. So Kurt, well, I do agree that like on paper, you know, having piles of carrots or, you know, asparagus with chorizo in the middle of it is not great to just pick up and eat with your hands. The judges were ready to get their hands dirty at that point. So I think they relished at the opportunity.
Yeah, I think the other thing that they whiffed on, and I know that they're not told that you have to cook beef, but it's called beefsteak. That's the name of the competition. And I think that Tom says something very on point at one point in the episode after everybody has kind of, you know, gone through serving up their meals. He's like, you can think too far outside the box sometimes. Like, you know, this attempt to, you know, come up with something that's not beef steak. You can cook beef in a very fun, inventive, messy, on-message way. Why not just do that if the competition is called beef steak? This is your chance to serve up some ridiculously awesome red meat. So I feel like going for the chicken sausage was a strange call. Obviously, the lamb works out, but I feel like in a competition called beefsteak, this is where you're getting your cowboy ribeyes out. You know, this is where you're getting like your crazy short rib situation going on. So that was really surprising that the chef testants really seemed to whiff on that concept, which felt to me like a no brainer.
When I saw Isaac's pile of sausage, I thought that is what the judges are looking for. They just want a big plate. Like I thought about the times I've gone to, like, you know, a Brazilian churrascura or like, you know, and you just keep getting these like just skewers of beef just coming around. And
it's the red light, green light situation.
Exactly.
Yep. Yeah.
And just like I just got the sense the judges were waiting for like a big plate of whatever. Like just
they were waiting for what Jason made in Last Chance Kitchen, basically. Yeah. They were waiting for a giant chunk of meat that they could just bite into.
And I was wondering, did pairing this challenge up with the quick fire just mess with their minds too much? Like something that was all about presentation and soignée to something that is completely not soignée. Did some of the contestants maybe think there was more of a linkage, like that they were trying to bring soignée to a beefsteak, or I don't know. It seemed like so many of them missed the mark.
I agree. I mean, I think Chad said it best when he said, "I'm trying to go from food porn to beast mode," which maybe now that maybe beefsteak is Caleb Reynolds' favorite restaurant just based on that adjective alone. But yeah, I think it was a way for the production to, I think, kind of throw them off with their game a little bit, because that's kind of what Top Chef is taking these really technically good chefs and putting them in really high pressure situations. But yeah, I think even with Chad specifically, he was really focused on still creating a fine dish in this really primal setting. I mean, also, were the judges kind of jerks in this challenge, guys? I mean, they were scoffing. Padma was throwing microgreens away. Hugh Atchison threw a bone at somebody in the table behind them. I mean, I think the judges were ready for like a raucous atmosphere, but they were a little out of control, I feel.
Yeah, they were booing dishes as they were being set down. Like Tom sees Chad's dishes, boo, boo, dainty, dainty, and he's pointing at it, booing as it's being sat down on the table. So it's like they were really embracing the beefsteak for sure.
That's what I saw it more as embracing the beefsteak as opposed to being jerks. It was a little bit like a roast, no pun intended. Yeah. In terms of putting on, it's almost like they had to assume a beefsteak persona. Like how it's just like the chef testants had to kind of adapt their cooking approach to beefsteak. I think the judges had to adjust how their commentary and their judging to the beefsteak environment as well. And I actually thought they did a really good job.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think, you know, listen, if they were being jerks, which they very well may have been, I don't think it's unwarranted. Yeah. You know, I feel like that there was a big, big whiff on this challenge. And I think if you're them and if you're Tom Colicchio and you're going to beefsteak expecting beefsteak and you're going to be palling around with Colin Hanks, you don't want these people to be serving you microgreens on tuna slices in front of freaking Colin Hanks.
Well, can we talk about that? Yeah. Was Colin Hanks just happen to sit down next to them, or did they actively seek out Colin Hanks to say, "Come eat a beefsteak with us, Colin. You're such a food connoisseur."
Well, he wasn't even like billed as Colin Hanks in the Chiron until like the third time he appeared on screen. And then they're like, okay, yeah, that is Colin Hanks. I thought that was Colin Hanks, but we weren't told until like around like the second or third meal that he was served.
Yeah, he was getting the May treatment.
He also got the actor-director co-billing, which good for Colin Hanks, I guess. Yeah. Notable director, Colin Hanks.
Though I will say the guest that overshadows Colin Hanks, in my opinion, is Matt Selman, who is the man with the top hat with the steak on it. He is the co-founder of Beefsteak, apparently, but he's probably most well-known as an executive producer and writer on The Simpsons. And as a giant Simpsons fan, I was elated to see someone even tangentially related to the show on Top Chef. And he definitely did impress in terms of being a ridiculous over-the-top character in this challenge.
He was demanding sexism. He was demanding it. And Chef Isaac said, "Well, I want to put my sausage in your mouth." And then he said, "Oh, that was a success. That was a success." So yeah, he was really beefsteaking it up for sure. The leader of Argus was there, Josh. Did I catch that? She was from Arrow. We saw her there somewhere.
Is that
in the
right?
Crowd.
Yeah.
Cynthia Adai Robinson.
Yeah, so she was there. Who knows what other luminaries were in the house.
Isn't that Chef Jacques? No, never mind.
that's Ra's al Ghul, the North African spice.
Got it. Great spice. Love that spice.
Lazarus Pit Barbecue.
Damn it, that's great, Kurt. Yeah. Oh, man. Well, you guys are going to have to figure out the hashtag for this one. I don't have anything. Too many good options here. But yeah, I think we really kind of have covered the essence of the beefsteak. You know, the goal there is the medieval times, the big plate, the meaty food. The judges,
Antonio, what would you have made? What's your move if you're going into beefsteak? And let's give you the meat dish. Let's say you're the man behind the meat.
I think the problem with this challenge, and I think Chef Chris Castenio says it at the judges table, is when Chad is talking about how the challenge kind of rattled him. Chris Castenio says being chefs about getting around the limitations and using your creativity to kind of confront those challenges. That's what growth is, he says, you know, and I think that's solid feedback for the challenge and for life. I'm not really dodging the question. I think that it's difficult. I mean, for example, you can cook ribs, you can smoke ribs, you can do that. That takes a lot of time. And it's also very difficult to put that kind of food forward for that many people. So when you're talking about meat dishes, a lot of meat dishes immediately come to mind, but you have to deal with the limitations of the challenge, namely the time that you have and the number of people that you have to serve. And I think that that's very difficult. And I don't know how much that really came out in the episode, but I think that's a huge part of it, is that you could cook a giant slab of ribs and you could go that route, but it's very difficult. I really did like the beef loin dish that was cooked. I don't know why the judges didn't seem to think that that was enough.
Too small.
Yeah, the pieces of meat were too small. I mean, I don't know what they wanted there, but this just didn't work. Top Chef presents a lot of interesting opportunities to do things that you would never do in a restaurant setting because of the cost. So here's an opportunity maybe to roast giant lobes of foie gras and really find a way to use that. I probably would have gotten into the game in something like that, something truly decadent. And I would have definitely, especially if I'm cooking on Marjorie's team and she's making a bread to sop up juices, I would have made sure that I cooked a meat dish that had a lot more juice and blood in it as it was coming out to the table. Yeah. And I do think that they failed in that respect for sure. But it's not like you can cook. It's not like you can cook like brisket in the time period that you have. I mean, I'm not sure. Maybe you can sous vide something. Maybe you can find a way to speed up the preparation. But some of those meats that are really good and really giant, they just take a really long time to roast or smoke. And I'm just not sure that this challenge afforded that opportunity. So I think that something with a lot more juice. And I really did like the beef loin dish, although I guess the pieces weren't big enough. But that looked really cool to me, taking a piece of beef loin in your hand, dipping it and just eating it that way rather than eating it with a fork and a knife. I thought that was
pretty cool. That's pretty cool. You know what? He wins the challenge and everything, and so you got to give credit for that. But I do think that Philip is on the money with, like, let's give him something to hold on to. You know, make a bone-in meat, something you can just pick up and just savage. And I think that he's the guy who got it the most for my money.
Yeah.
Though, I'll say I think that he sort of benefited from the fact that nearly everyone else, with the exception of like the people that made the side dishes, everyone else who cooked meats basically all missed the mark. So I do think that had Carl even just put bigger steaks on, I think he would have won. Because I think Philip had a huge detracting point to the fact that he did not cook beef. He decided to go for lamb, and Jeremy was even adamant about saying, like, are you sure you don't want to cook beef? But because everyone else kind of screwed everything up, Philip was able to get ahead with lamb and able to pull out a win because of that.
The moment I saw Carl slicing the beef, the strip loin into like smaller, like manageable sizes, like manageable, it seems like almost like the opposite of the intent of beefsteak. I mean, I don't know if you want to put the whole thing out there and have people like tear it with their hands, but if you're going to like divide it, like cut it or slice it, do it like in a really kind of messy way that I don't know, that just seemed to throw me. And the judges seem to like Isaac's sausage, but they're like, you know, they even said during the judging, if you're going to give us sausage, don't give us chicken sausage, let alone dry chicken sausage. So it's, I don't think it was necessarily the fact that, you know, Isaac didn't do beef. I think it was more like, You know, give us some pork sausage.
Yeah. Look, I love chicken sausage. Chicken sausage is great. Fantastic diet food for anybody.
And to be fair, 40% of it was pork. I forgot that.
Yeah. But I think there's something there. It's like, all right, you know, chicken sausage is, there's a time and a place and it's fantastic, but you're a beefsteak. Give me something greasy and gross, and that's the kind of sausage I want.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that's the major detracting point of this challenge, again, is that the judges wanted greasy and gross, but I think these chefs come from environments, even Isaac, where cooking greasy and gross is not good. When you're cooking in a restaurant, people usually don't want to eat greasy and gross food. So it's really tough to, even in a Top Chef environment, put your mind in that viewpoint to just make something that looks disgusting on the plate.
Yeah, I think they should have. I mean, I think they should have got this better. Maybe it was the problem was David Spade, David Grohl introducing it in kind of a really kind of blasé kind of way. But it just didn't
really Everlong with the presentation of that.
Yeah, it just didn't. I mean, they didn't get the best of you in this dish for sure. It just didn't play out the way it should have. I think the shopping also plays a part. I mean, you can cook giant turkey legs, medieval time style, but how many turkeys do you have to buy? And can you really buy that many turkeys at the store? And can you really afford that many in the constraints that you're given? And I mention this because one of the things that's been going on throughout the season we haven't really talked about is NOLA.com, the website in New Orleans, has been doing a Q&A with Isaac after each episode. And Isaac kind of talks about that everyone – that the shopping part and the stress part are big parts of the competition. And we see the shopping part on the show. It's always been kind of a joke. It's like nothing ever really happens at the shopping part. Occasionally, somebody won't find an ingredient that they need, and that will come to play a big part in the elimination challenge. But most of the time, there aren't any real dramatic moments in the shopping. But the shopping does play a part. You do have a constraint. You are limited to what's in-house at whatever local Whole Foods you're at. And so maybe you aren't able to get as many turkey legs as you need. You just have to go with something kind of run-of-the-mill. Making your own sausage is a great idea. But yeah, chicken is just not as greasy as it needs to be. And then it really did look like he was sort of priming the sausage and that some of the fat might have gotten out there. So I don't know. I think the sausage was a good plan. There is a chain of German restaurants called Hofbrauhaus, which we have here in Cincinnati. They have them a couple other places in the U.S. now. They have a kind of everybody's sitting at these long tables, standing on them, drinking giant glasses of beer, shouting. It's that Oktoberfest kind of presentation. So I think that there you're getting those giant sausage plates or giant, you know, just slabs of meat are coming out. And that's what's expected. So you guys are right that I think these chefs come from an environment where that isn't in play. But I feel like the challenge should have been pretty clear what they were supposed to do. And I think that that's difficult. Chad is the one who's most notorious for not adapting to this. He's using tweezers to plate. And he's putting microgreens and little slices of things on.
And he's doing this, I'm just sitting there staring at the TV being like, it's over.
Yeah, you're waiting for the guillotine to fall.
You know, I've already been on Death Watch for, you know, a couple weeks now. But like, I knew, you know, you can't do that. Not at beefsteak, man. Come on.
That's right. I love the Jacques Lemaire Twitter account or is that our Instagram account. I think part of the profile is like tweezers, everything.
I was really surprised, by the way, about the beefsteak. I thought that one of the chefs that we haven't really talked about, Chef Kwame, his dish was great. I mean, I think that it got applauded when it got sat down. They were pointing at it like, this is what we want. It was awful. It was awful. It was a bad dish.
I'm starting to see a little bit of a Gregory-esque streak for Kwame now in terms of both guys were big front runners in the first bunch of episodes. And now, like Gregory, Kwame's been at the bottom for two episodes now. And I wonder, I don't think he's going to go home in the next few episodes. And maybe I'm jinxing myself because of that. But I'm wondering if he's going to have a very similar trajectory of Gregory in terms of riding the bottom for a couple episodes more and then just having a giant spike in productivity and doing well again.
Yeah, it is interesting because I think that we've seen three or four episodes where Kwame has saved someone from elimination, whether it's his team or whether it's an individual chef with his little work that he's done, whether it's his dish that has caused his team to not be on the bottom, whether it's a sauce he's made that saved another chef's dish. In this instance, Kwame was saved by his teammates. He really was, because I think in particular, Carl's beef, because Kwame's team did not end up on the bottom. And if his team had ended up on the bottom, I think it's unquestionable that Kwame would have gone home.
Yep. And not just Carl's beef, but you know, they really liked Karen's vegetable dish as well.
It's a fair point. It's a fair point, Kurt.
Vegetable in quotations, because it was asparagus with chorizo, which I had a little bit of a question about, because I think Jeremy made something with bacon too. And I wonder,
it was a side dish, not a vegetable dish. There's no
side
foul
dish that
there.
Also contained meat,
which is fine.
Beefsteak, Mike.
Yeah,
I know,
Mike?
But I just feel like
Mike, drop the soigné attitude.
Shame.
Jeez,
shame.
Come on.
I feel like, you know, we needed some more decadence going on.
So those Brussels sprout sides can't have bacon because it's meat. Whatever, Mike Bloom. Come on. Get with it. This is the angriest I've gotten the entire series run of this podcast.
I know. How un-Brian Voltaggio of you to be so fired.
I know.
Wow, he just went hard Mike Voltaggio
on
you.
The coffee just kicked in, Mike, and it's on you.
Which one did we choose today?
Beefsteak one.
I did reach into the grab bag of coffee pods, and it is a 8 o'clock.
Beefsteak coffee.
It was actually called 8 o'clock hazelnut.
Amazing.
Oh boy, is that the Metallica or the Weezer of coffee choices? Did you guys I love that Philip comparison, because that is so Philip to be like, well, it was like the judges wanted Metallica and then Weezer came out. Not to say Weezer isn't a bad band, I'm like, of course you like Weezer, Philip.
Well, but it was a good analogy though.
So early Weezer, I'm down with. I can get with early Weezer. I don't know if any of you guys have ever been to a Weezer concert before.
They opened for No Doubt.
Weezer, I really loved Weezer when I was younger, and I was so excited to go to my first Weezer concert. It was like at Jones Beach, and I was so pumped up. I hadn't been to many concerts before, and I got there. It was just the worst. They just stand there. They just stand there the whole time and do absolutely nothing. So if your food is being compared to Weezer, I'm thinking Weezer concert, and that's some pretty bad stuff.
I thought Phil made the comparison because their food looked like Buddy Holly.
Oh.
Thank you.
Yes. You need to put Mary Tyler Moore thought into that next time, Mike. Mike, I like that joke, but I cannot make them like it. All right. Like, it's fine.
If you want to destroy this analogy, keep going. I see what I did there.
What did you guys think about? So we got feedback here about the kind of where the teams break out. Philip and Amar and Jeremy are at the top. Philip does win, as we talked about. We talked about how he kind of really embraced the challenge pretty well. And the lamb also ate well, tasted good. So those are all good things in favor of his dish. But their team was at the top. The bottom team was Marjorie, Chad, and Isaac. Isaac stands behind his dish. He does say, I like it, but I cannot make you like it, which I think is very good defense. We see the chefs, the judges kind of nodding like, yeah, we're with it. We understand you're standing by your dish. Tom says Marjorie's the best baker they've ever had on the show.
Wow. I feel like Tom says that kind of thing a lot in recent seasons, where it's like, this is the best blank we've ever had. This is the best thing. This is the best we've ever seen on the show.
He's showing Probst-like hyperbole there.
He's just forgetting the past.
Past is neat. Yeah, we can forget the past in some instances. I mean, shoot, they didn't even give May anything on the downstream.
That's
<John.
true>. Yeah.
Unreal.
So,
that's Jacques Lemaire, right? She appeared in the last episode.
that was the twist.
Jacques Lemay.
Yes. What I think it's really fascinating, because the fundamental kind of underpinning of Top Chef gets exposed here in the elimination challenge, which is Chad's dish, as the judges admit, ate well. They liked it. It tasted good. But it really wasn't in the confines of the challenge very much. And Isaac made a dish that was well within the confines of the challenge, but they didn't like it. They thought it was underseasoned. They thought it was dry. They didn't really like it at all. And so the question becomes, like, what is elimination worthy? And Tom has a really good quote, which I think sums up how these challenges should work on Top Chef. I'm not sure they always do. Tom says, If we don't go by the parameters of the challenge, people will just do whatever they want. So we have to set some boundaries. We have to drop the hammer at some points. And ultimately, Team Wiggler loses its final member. Chad Galifianakis goes down in flames here, and he's out of the competition for basically cooking good food that just wasn't really in the confines of the challenge. Do you guys feel like we've always done this on Top Chef, that we've been consistent that a good dish can go home if it's not in the confines of the challenge? Because I really don't feel that way. I feel like Top Chef sometimes invents reasons to send people home and sometimes doesn't follow this golden rule of, if you follow the rules of the challenge and your food isn't good, you're going to be more likely to stay versus someone who has good food but didn't follow the rules of the challenge.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think that, I mean, I think that the basic conundrum of Top Chef always comes down to a case where someone stuck within the parameters of the challenge but cooked a bad meal versus someone who cooked a good meal but was not within the parameters of the challenge. And I really think we can probably go back in Top Chef's history, even though Tom doesn't. And really, I feel like it's almost 50-50 split, where half the time the person that cooked the good meal but wasn't within the parameters would go home. And 50% of the time, the person that cooked the bad meal but was within the parameters would go home. So I think it's honestly a coin toss at some point. I mean, looking, if we compare Isaac and Chad as well, even though Isaac was in the bottom last episode, I feel like he has a stronger overall body of work than Chad did. So I know the judges try to not incorporate the history into viewing each contestant, but I feel like that might have come into play a little bit here as well.
Kurt, do you feel like that the person that goes home is just the least compelling person usually, and it really is just who they feel like they should send home from a TV standpoint? Are we trending into that territory with Top Chef? Did Isaac stay around for the main reason of Isaac is better television than Chad? Is that, do you worry that that enters into the equation at all, or do you feel like Top Chef is above reproach?
I wouldn't say that I worry about it. I wouldn't be surprised if it did factor into it. I mean, I haven't looked at the fine print during the closing credits where, you know, sometimes you'll see, you know, production has a say in who potentially goes home. For some shows, you will see that. But this was a weird one again, because we talked about how the judges kind of took on these beefsteak personas when they came to their judging. And I think that might have actually been a bit part of why Chad went home over Isaac, that it was like in terms of this being a challenge, you know, sculpted around the concept of beefsteak, Isaac tried to embrace the concept of beefsteak and Chad microgreens. Come on. And so I didn't have a problem with this, especially because it meant that Josh's run came to an end.
Well, I gotta side with Kurt. Like, and this is coming from the guy who lost his entire steak, his entire beef steak in the competition with Chad going home. And I think that, you know, looking at the two people who were clearly going to be up, it was Isaac or it was Chad. You can absolutely make the argument that Isaac is better television. He's, you know, he gives great confessional. He's inventive. He's funny in the kitchen. He's a big personality. Is that a reason to keep him? Not in the spirit of Top Chef. And I think in the past, Top Chef has eliminated people that are probably better TV than the other person who is up for it.
That happened for like the first five episodes this season.
You know, I think that the show has a really good track record with that. So I'm not gonna start, you know, pointing fingers on that front. And I think that Isaac may have made a dish that wasn't as that didn't taste as good, that wasn't as good as what Chad made, but Chad's was not in the spirit of the beefsteak competition, and it also wasn't a transcendent meal. So if you're picking between two where you could go either way, I like that Top Chef is saying stick to the competition, stick to the parameters of what we're telling you to do, embrace the spirit of the challenge, otherwise this is what happens. So I'm on Tom's side for what Tom says there, where it's basically like you can go too far outside the rules, and sometimes we really just gotta, you know, we gotta bring it down on that. So yeah. I'm good with Chad going home here.
I am too. I think we should plant a flag here, like I like to do. I think we should plant a flag in this, because I think as we look at further eliminations throughout the course of the season, Mike, I think you pointed out what you call the central conundrum of Top Chef is, you know, do you send someone home for making a good dish if it's not in the confines of the rules versus somebody who doesn't really embrace the challenge? I think where we see this most is people playing it safe in the elimination challenge, where they don't really go crazy and get inspired by the challenge. They play it very safe. They, you know, they keep their head down and they don't go home for sticking their neck out. And I think that that's most often where we see it. People don't usually get sent home for that. Occasionally they do when it is a kind of an all things being equal scenario. I don't know though, when one dish tastes good and one dish doesn't, when one dish is under seasoned and one dish is, it eats well, when one dish is dry and the other isn't, I really don't know that, that you can say all things are equal. I definitely agree that. And of course I love Chef Isaac. He's been my favorite since the beginning of the season. But I do think that this is an example of Top Chef really sticking their neck out and saying the challenge rules matter. And I'm okay with that. I just think we should remember this episode and remember this moment, the beefsteak moment, when we look at future eliminations and if we're rewatching any old ones, because I promise you, Top Chef has not consistently done this.
And if Top Chef is sticking its head out, hopefully we won't have to cut out its cheeks and eyes and tongue to use later on.
I like what you're doing here, Mike.
I also just think I think it's I hear all of that, Antonio, and I think you're right. And I think that the thing to remember about a show like this is it's judged by people who can only be subjective. You know, they can try and be as objective as humanly possible, but at the end of the day, they are people and they are going to make somewhat subjective calls. And so if it's not consistent across the board, I understand that. I think that they are mostly consistent, and I think more often than not, they get it right. So I'm not too harsh on penalizing them on that stuff.
Yeah, I think Isaac really benefited from the fact that so few people really did embrace this challenge. Mm-hmm. And his meal was one that really was right. I mean, maybe more than any that they got was right in the realm of what this challenge needed to be. It would have been very interesting if we saw the team with Kwame and Karen and Carl end up at the bottom. Would we have seen the same thing play out? Because by all accounts, Karen and Carl made very good food. Kwame did not. But Kwame's was right in the zone of the challenge, and theirs were disappointing in that regard. And so maybe the fact that Carl did serve meat that could be picked up with his hands was better than what Chad did. I don't know. But I mean, there has to be a limit to that at some point. So it's just fascinating to me because you're right. They try to do the best they can. It is ultimately something that can't be fully objective, that there has to be some subjectivity to it. And I think in this particular instance, the fact that Chef Isaac did go within the rules of the competition when so few other people did, I think that played a big goal. Before we move on to Last Chance Kitchen, Josh, do you want to eulogize Chad Galifianakis at all?
Nope.
Fantastic. Chad's parting words were that Top Chef is harder than the military. So I'm sure Bravo loved getting that comment from Chad.
Oh yeah. Oh. I feel like Bravo's viewer base totally agreed with that statement. Yeah,
exactly. So we move on. Chad will cook again in Last Chance Kitchen, son of Top Chef. And Chad in Last Chance Kitchen gets a meat challenge, as Mike was referring. There is basically just giant slabs of meat in the kitchen. The peanut gallery wheels them out, including a whole beef head, which is serious nightmare fuel. Was anyone else terrified of that beef head? I was terrified.
Yeah. My wife is one of these people that she'll cook meat, but she can't. If there's like something that's whole that she'll have to like cut into to butcher, she won't do it, to the point of where like she won't eat like lobster or crayfish or anything that you have to actually crack into its body and eat. So she would have had a nightmare amount of time with this challenge.
Yeah, I tend to avoid food with faces.
You're not into face food?
No.
You don't like little pancakes with like butter and bacon and eggs and all that?
Like a little mustache made out of bacon. I run screaming from the IHOP when I see that.
Well, you could run screaming from the IHOP for a myriad of reasons. So mostly that's one of them.
Don't run screaming from the cheek hop, though. Chad takes the eyes, the cheek, and one other thing. Well, the tongue.
The tongue.
From this beef head, and he's going to serve it up to Tom. Tom has never eaten eyes before. Tom has clearly...
Never eaten eyes before?
Well, he eats with his eyes, not eyes.
Wow. Oh, boy. Pork chop bone. So, yeah, Tom's never... Apparently, he's just never been in the wilderness with Bear Grylls, so he's never really had to pop an eye in the mouth for a little protein. But, so Chad cooks this all up. He makes a chili, which is really kind of a cool idea, I think. Makes me a little nervous about any previous chilies that I've eaten. But he also talked about how he puts eyes in tortillas. Did you guys catch that?
Yeah, to make them moist.
Oh, gosh. I love tortillas, but I had no idea that they were that unvegan. This is a brutal, brutal realization for me in my life. I really liked this Last Chance Kitchen. I thought it was great. I thought both chefs really embraced what they needed to do in Last Chance Kitchen. I thought both really pushed it to the limit from a prep standpoint, from a time standpoint. Unfortunately, it did bite Chad a little bit because his cheeks were a little underdone. Maybe that's because they were covered by beard. Who knows? But ultimately, Jason does win in the Last Chance Kitchen. And only now he only has like four more people left.
It's surprising. I mean, we predicted last week that he would be one and done, that he beat Angelina, but that was almost like, you know, beating a kindergartner at Last Chance Kitchen. And now he has to face off against a much bigger competition. I mean, Chad coming in, feel like him or Philip could be like the two people that Jason would have a chance of beating on paper. But Jason sort of surprised me here, because as even Tom pointed out, Jason's known for very decadent, very eclectic foods. You know, he was known as the historian before he left the show. And now he just takes this giant bone-in ribeye and cooks a big slab of meat in a pizza oven. So it was very unlike Jason. And I wonder if that was also kind of what helped nudge him to the win.
It wasn't just a bone-in ribeye. It was a chuletón bone-in ribeye. So it had to have some fancy element to it.
Yeah, and he wasn't even at the beefsteak. So somehow he knew exactly what to deliver. Good for Jason. He's around. He's going to face – it's a good possibility he faces some really stiff competition next week, because we do get the tease. It's Restaurant Wars. I'm not sure if we're going to have a Last Chance Kitchen next week. We're going to get into exactly the Restaurant Wars tease here at the end of the podcast. But if people don't want to be spoiled on that, I'd say you guys can tune out now. Do you have a hashtag? Anybody have a good hashtag people can use? We had so many suggestions.
Do we want to go with Jacques Lemay?
I had Jacques Lemay as one of mine. I had Ron Soignier and Jacques Lemay.
Josh, any ideas?
You liked Lazarus Pit BBQ.
That was fantastic. Lazarus Pit Barbecue. But no, I don't know. I'm up for anything. You guys decide.
Jacques Lemay is good.
That's okay. Good. I think it's easy enough to spell.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. No. So give us a spelling, Mike. How would you like it spelled?
Jacques Lemay. In honor of, once again, the egregious snubbing of May in week's episode.
So if you don't want to hear about what's going to happen at the Restaurant Wars next week and the week after, you can tune out now. Thanks for listening. Tweet at us with that hashtag. You can tweet at Mike at A Mike Bloom Type. You can tweet at Josh at Round Howard. I'm at AC Mazzaro, and Kurt is at Kurt Clark. So thank you very much for listening. If you don't want to be spoiled, if you do want to be spoiled, let's get into it. We're just going to go with what's in the trailer there. We have the most supersized Restaurant Wars coming up in Top Chef history. Not only are we going to do a dinner service, we're going to do a lunch service. It's a two-part episode. Everyone has to take a shift as either the executive chef or the front of the house. This could be, there's no hiding, as they say. The teams were spoiled. Did you guys see this?
Yep. I have a very vested interest in one team. Let me just say that.
Yeah. I did, but I don't remember who was on them, if you can run them down.
Yeah. So it's Kwame, Jeremy, Philip, and Amar versus Marjorie, Karen, Carl, and Isaac.
Wow.
Yeah. So we've got a lot vested there in Team Isaac and Marjorie, Josh. We've also got Jeremy. Mike, you're really all on board there.
It's basically Team Mike versus Team Kurt with the Josh Antonio writing the middle there.
Yeah, Mike, I mean, just looking at that split, you do have Philip on your squad, and that just seems to me like that's going to be bad.
I know I'm completely boned. I'm boned in ribeye.
it's about time.
It's going to be, I mean, Kwame has not been doing well. Amar has been fine, but he's like the Susan Lucci of Top Chef, and that he's always a bridesmaid, never the bride. Jeremy's pretty strong, but he's gotten flummoxed a couple times, and Philip is just Philip. I'm predicting a loss here. I'm hoping Philip goes, just so, you know, Kwame and Amar can stay in, because I consider them the stronger chef. So that's what I'm hoping for over the next 2 weeks. That's the best outcome for me.
That said, I mean, Restaurant Wars famously clips like the front runners. You know, Restaurant Wars is famously like the killing grounds for people who are traditionally thought of as front runners in this competition, or people who are going to do really well. I could see Jeremy getting toasted in Restaurant Wars. Like, I could see something like that happening. I could see like a Kristen Kish situation. I can absolutely see someone who we think is doing really, really well in this competition getting bone and ribeyed by Restaurant Wars.
Okay, just check.
Yes.
That honestly might happen. Yeah. And we saw, you know, Jeremy kind of yell at Philip in the teaser. So I can only imagine. Now, you're right, Josh. Jeremy might be one of these people that it was. I even think back to like Restaurant Wars in season 3, where Trey was like one of the big front runners and he gets taken out in Restaurant Wars.
Yeah.
So I feel like it's one of those things where the front runners really get a lot of pressure put on them, and some people really crack under the pressure and they get eliminated as a result.
Yeah, like Kenny in season 7 is like the most egregious example. Like, he was the guy who should have won that season. Like, he was the guy up until that point in the competition where he was just awesome and he just does not make it through Restaurant Wars, and it's still a travesty in my mind that he has not been brought back. So I feel like that's the kind of thing that you expect out of Restaurant Wars. Like, yeah, odds on favorite to go is Philip because he's just a lunatic. But I feel like Restaurant Wars ends up being just this bad spot for the people who were really, really good. So I could see a Jeremy going, I could see Marjorie going, I could see Karen, I could see a lot of people going here. I think it's going to be, once again, like, the thing that's been great about this season is how wide open it's been. And I can only imagine that a two-part Restaurant Wars is going to be epic. It's going to be epic, and it's going to claim someone big.
Kurt, do you feel like they're course correcting a little bit with this requirement that somebody either has to be exec chef or front of house? Is this kind of, do you think, to correct a situation where people have been hiding as line cooks in Restaurant Wars and letting other people stick their necks out and take the sword?
I don't necessarily think so. I didn't watch the trailer for the next week, so I'm just kind of reacting on the fly here. But it sounds like I almost get more of the impression that they're like, oh, how can we've done Restaurant Wars at Final Eight for how many seasons now? What's a way that we could potentially change it up and make it bigger and more interesting? And like serving a lunch and a dinner course and having people rotate. To me, that sounds like more of an evolution of Restaurant Wars than trying to correct for anything necessarily in the past.
Well, let's also remember last season, Carrie Ann got pushed into front of house and they butchered her meal, pun not intended there, and she got eliminated because of it. So
right.
If they're trying to course correct, maybe they're even trying to course correct from last season, saying Carrie Ann got eliminated for a dish that she basically created on paper but didn't actually cook. So they're trying to say, well, actually everyone will be responsible for their own meals at one point in time, so we can judge them based on that.
I don't know. I can't see them having, like, you know, production meetings about, you know, oh gosh, you know, Carrie Ann went home. How do we prevent this from happening again next year? I see it more just, how do we evolve something? I think we're overthinking it.
Well, yeah, we'll see exactly how it evolves and how it does play out. We see in the trailer, Philip is wearing a front of house coat. So he's going to get to the front of the house. We see Marjorie in the front of the house. So we know those two at least take their shift front of house. We see Carl in a really rough executive chef moment.
Serving the judges raw fish.
Yeah, give the judges raw fish. I don't care. And so I don't know. I don't know if what that really looks like in editing versus what happens. We'll just have to wait and see. I'm not sure anyone's going home next week. If it's a two-parter, I don't think, are we getting back-to-back episodes next week? Are we getting 2 weeks worth of Last Chance Kitchen and no elimination next week? So we'll just have to see how it all plays out. Very excited about it. Restaurant Wars, obviously, always a high water mark for most seasons of Top Chef. Anything else about this episode before we wrap up here?
No.
All right. Well, thank you very much for listening. And thank you guys again for the roundtable today. Great episode of Top Chef. A lot of fun talking about it. If you like what we're doing here at Rob Has a Website in the Reality Rehap-Ups, you can, as always, subscribe. RobHasAWebsite.com/Rehap-Ups. And that will get you to our iTunes link to subscribe to everything we're doing in the Reality Rehap-Ups feed. Otherwise, look forward to talking to everybody next week. Take care.